Knowledge Product presents The Giants of Philosophy, narrated by Charlton Heston. This is tape number one on Arthur Schopenhauer. In 1781, a philosophical revolution disrupted the world of ideas with consequences as far-reaching as those of any political revolution. Immanuel Kant published a book, Critique of Pure Reason, that established new canons of thought for nearly every area of philosophy. But in philosophy, as in political life, the sons of a revolution generally shape its development according to their own ideals. Arthur Schopenhauer, born in the Prussian city of Danzig in 1788, was indeed one of the sons of the intellectual revolution begun by Kant. Kant's influence is visible throughout Schopenhauer's work, yet he pursues his own line of thought in a highly original and individual way. The most distinctive quality of Schopenhauer's thought is his pessimism. He prominently discusses the dark aspects of our existence. Evil, pain, and suffering are not aberrations to be explained away by philosophy. Rather, they inevitably express the inner nature of the world. In Schopenhauer's view, the dominant force moving the world is the blind, endlessly striving will to live. This insatiable will to live is hidden from us, but it still presents us with a visible appearance that Schopenhauer calls representation. In very few words, he communicates the original idea that lies at the heart of his pessimistic philosophy.
This world in which we live and have our being is by its whole nature, through and through, will, and at the same time, through and through, representation.
This single thought is the subject of Schopenhauer's major work, The World as Will and Representation. This concept of will is the basis for his view of the nature of existence, his description of art's role in human life, and his account of morality. The first edition of The World as Will and Representation was published in 1818, when Schopenhauer was only 30 years old. The central ideas of his philosophy were already well established, and they were to change little between this time and his death in 1860. When Schopenhauer published his book, he was certain that he'd presented the true answers to the basic questions in philosophy. His views openly contradicted those favored in the universities. Schopenhauer knew this. He doubted his book would be well received. In the preface to the first edition, he says the truth of his ideas will probably meet the same fate as truth in all branches of knowledge, and all the more so because philosophy is the most important branch.
I am resigned in patience to the fact that the same fate will befall it in full measure which has fallen to the lot of truth in every branch of knowledge, in the most important branch most of all. To truth, only a brief celebration of victory is allowed between the two long periods during which it is condemned as paradoxical or disparaged as trivial. The author of truth also usually meets with the form of a fate.
Schopenhauer's resigned attitude was more than justified. His book suffered a fate worse than damning criticism or harsh rebuttal. It was ignored. There were no sympathetic ears to hear this new philosophical voice. This unsympathetic reception may be partly explained by some aspects of Schopenhauer's life and personality, which were as unusual and original as his thought. He was financially independent and independent in spirit. Because of his finances, he didn't have to become a university professor to pursue his philosophical work. He could express his ideas freely and fully vent his passionate and independent spirit. He openly defied the views of the academic philosophers who were his contemporaries. One reason for his rebellion may be that his early education was designed to point him to a career in business rather than academia. Schopenhauer recognized that his father was in no small measure responsible for his passion and independence. Heinrich Floris Schopenhauer, a wealthy merchant, was fiercely independent. When Schopenhauer was only 5 years old, the Prussians had invaded the family's home city of Danzig. Rather than suffer the oppression of a foreign rule, Heinrich moved his family to Hamburg, in spite of some substantial loss to his own wealth. Naturally, Heinrich planned for his son to follow in the family mercantile business. He made every effort to educate young Arthur about the world. The family traveled extensively throughout Europe when Schopenhauer was just a boy. At age 10, Arthur was even sent to live for 2 years with one of his father's business associates in France, who had a son Arthur's age. There he learned to speak French fluently. When he returned to Germany, he continued his formal education in a private school until he was 16. To his father's dismay, Schopenhauer became increasingly enamored with his studies, especially philosophy. He began to have ambitions of becoming a scholar. Heinrich, who saw little future in an academic life, offered his son a choice. Either he could pursue his studies in philosophy, or he could travel for 2 years through Belgium, France, Switzerland, Austria, and Germany, whereupon he would return to a career in business. At the age of 17, Schopenhauer chose to devote 2 years to travel and adventure. He returned home in 1804 and entered the family business. But several events led Schopenhauer out of a career in business and into philosophy. The first was his father's death the following year. Heinrich Schopenhauer had suffered for some time from depression. He fell from a window of his firm's warehouse into the canal below, where he drowned. This caused suspicions that he'd committed suicide. The family sold its interest in the mercantile firm and divided the money between Schopenhauer, his mother, and his sister. Schopenhauer managed his inheritance carefully and lived off its income for the rest of his life. His mother, Johanna, took her newly found means and freedom and moved to Weimar. Here she opened a literary salon where poets, authors, and philosophers of the city would gather for conversation. The poet Goethe and other important German literary figures often came there. Johanna herself began a literary career. She later published several popular romantic novels. After his father's death, Schopenhauer continued to work in the merchant's office. Not only had his grief dampened his scholarly ambitions, he also felt strongly that he should respect his father's wishes for him. But Schopenhauer grew more and more dissatisfied. Eventually, after two tedious and unpleasant years, he felt he could endure it no longer. Schopenhauer later reflected on his unhappiness during this period of his life.
Tormented by this unbearable suffering, I poured out my lamentations in a letter to my mother, who was already living in Weimar, complaining of my frustrated goals in life and of the irreplaceable loss of strength and youth employed in vain at a meaningless job.
Johanna consulted the visitors in her salon to see if they thought Arthur could make up lost time in pursuing a scholarly career. On their advice, Johanna encouraged Arthur to leave the business and return to his studies. No doubt Schopenhauer felt tremendous liberation in leaving Hamburg and moving to Weimar. Upon arriving, he hired a private tutor and threw himself into his studies with unbridled enthusiasm. For 2 years, he studied Greek and Latin classics, preparing to go to the university. He made phenomenal progress. At the same time, however, problems with his mother began. Johanna had been initially sympathetic to her son's unhappiness, but there was friction between them. Not long after he'd gone to Weimar and moved in with her, she urged him to get a separate apartment. In one of her letters to him during this time, we see this conflict. Schopenhauer's character was already disposed to pessimism. She writes,
"It is needful to my happiness to know that you are happy, but not to be a witness of it."
She then goes on to call attention to his disagreeable disposition.
"Your ill humor, your complaints of things inevitable, your sullen looks, the extraordinary opinions you utter, like oracles none may presume to contradict. All this depresses me, or troubles me, without helping you. Your eternal quibbles, your laments over the stupid world and human misery, give me bad nights and unpleasant dreams.